Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Hayden Gibson.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Now, Hayden, you were on earlier episodes. Which one? You were on the To the Lighthouse episode. Do you want to remind everyone out there about yourself and what else you do?
Yeah, I'm still on... I don't think I plugged it last time. Since then I have done what every person in their like early to mid 20s is doing on the internet. I have started an actual play D&D podcast where, you know, many, many fun times to be had, rollicking around in, adventuring world. And I've also started a podcast talking about queer media, called That Gay Shit. where we either take a canonically queer piece of media and just talk about it because we like it, or we take a non-canonically queer piece of media and try and come up with some sort of gay reading for it. Like, did you know, John, that 10 Things I Hate About You is actually about two bisexuals falling in love with each other?
No, I don't, but I'm eager to learn. So this time we are doing the 1999. You pointed this out. This is like the youngest book we've done on Sophomore Lit. We're doing the 1999 Stephen Chbosky book, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which I am told is taught a lot in high school these days. Did you?
I wasn't assigned it like I mentioned whenever I was on last time to talk about To the Lighthouse, I was homeschooled, so my English was real scattershot beyond just, you know, this is what an adjective and like a compound sentence is. I was mainly left to just read whatever I wanted. But around 14, a friend of mine, she came to me and was like, hey, this book, I read it, it's like really good and it means a lot to me. I want you to check it out. And I had never heard of it before. And so I read it and like this friend, I also fell in love with it. And then a couple years after that, the movie came out, which we then saw together, and that got us into Rocky Horror and a bunch of other stuff.
So yeah, you really have to like Rocky Horror Picture Show to love this book, because I, as you also pointed out, this book is about 50% Rocky Horror Picture Show.
This is like this borders at times on like an almost like Ready Player One Ernest Cline like list of things the author likes. It's a bit more well done than that, and feels a lot more organic that the characters would be talking about these things.
Right.
But there are just long sections where it's just like, oh, this, Sam gave me a mixtape of the Smiths and like the Shags to listen to, and so on and so forth.
Right. There are mixtapes and they list every song on the mixtape. So this does, as you say, this is a book about the author's tastes and obsessions. But it makes sense because this is written about, I think, the time in your life where you are probably as obsessed with whatever media you will be obsessed with as you ever will be. I think this is the time in your life where, I think that's the one thing the book gets really right, is that this is the time where you are trying to establish your personality. And one of the ways you establish your personality is by deciding what culture you're going to align yourself with.
Yeah, absolutely. If this was more, if I had written this when I was 15, it would have been mostly about manga and anime, because I was terrible.
Right. Now we'll get into the particular choices of this book in a minute. I'll say my background with this book is I have no background with this book. This book is way too young for me. Although I was interested to see this book was written in 99 and it's set in 91. And so it's actually set 5 years after I finished high school. I graduated high school in 86. And so a lot of the culture that this book talks about is very current to what I was, and certainly I shared a lot of the tastes of the author or a lot of the interests of the author. It's interesting to me that that's the way the author chose to do this. I think everyone, when they write a book about being a teenager, I think the easiest thing and the most authentic thing to do is to set it in the year that you were a teenager, because then you don't have to sit around and wonder, oh my God, did that one song exist then? Did, you know,
you can avoid the being Steve Buscemi,
yeah,
strolling up right, with your skateboard. How do you do, fellow kids?
Right. Okay, so let me give a quick rundown of this book. It's not, I'm not going to touch on everything because we can get into the individual scenes as we go along. But this story takes place in 1999, and our hero, Charlie, is writing letters to an unnamed friend about starting high school. While it's tough for any kid, Charlie is dealing with the suicide last year of his best friend Michael and still being sad about his favorite aunt Helen, who died when he was 7. His nameless brother and sister aren't much help, but in shop class he does meet a charming and sophisticated senior, Patrick, and later he meets Patrick's even more charming and more sophisticated stepsister, Sam. Sam and Patrick take the titular wallflower under their wings and initiate him into a world of parties, new wave music, and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. A lot of Rocky Horror Picture Show. Sam introduces Charlie to her bohemian friend Mary Elizabeth, but Charlie really only wants to be with Sam, or he would if he could ever become more engaged with his life. Bill, his English teacher, gives him a lot of the sort of books which are very meaningful in a novel to read. Patrick is secretly dating Brad, the quarterback for the high school team, who's closeted and whose abusive father makes him break things off with Patrick. Charlie's sister is also being abused by her boyfriend. Sam was abused as a child, and eventually Charlie realizes that he, too, was the victim of abuse at the hand of Aunt Helen. After a quick breakdown at the end of his freshman year, Charlie signs off to his still unnamed friend and decides to become more involved with life.
I don't know if I'll have the time to write any more letters, because I might be too busy trying to participate. So if this does end up being the last letter, I just want you to know that I was in a bad place before I started high school, and you helped me. Even if you didn't know what I was talking about, or know somebody who's gone through it, you made me feel not alone. Because I know there are people who say these things don't happen, and there are people who forget what it's like to be 16 when they turn 17. I know these will all be stories someday, and our pictures will just become old photographs. We all become somebody's mom or dad, but right now, these moments are not stories. This is happening. I am here, and I am looking at her, and she is so beautiful. I can see it. This one moment when you know you're not a sad story, you are alive. And you stand up and you see the lights on the buildings and everything that makes you wonder. And you're listening to that song and that drive with the people who you love the most in this world. And in this moment, I swear, we are infinite.
But that's the, in broad strokes, what this book is about.
It's not very important, like, to the overall themes or plot, what little plot there is in the novel, but one thing I did want to mention is that that I thought was very very true to being around 15 or 14, right, is Charlie mentions whenever he's talking about all the books that his English professor is giving them, he says that I think something like This Side of Paradise is my favorite book. I just read it. Any book that I any book that I finish automatically becomes my favorite book, which unless it was terrible, that's usually how I felt whenever I was reading. The only time that felt a bit false to me was whenever he said that his current favorite book, sometime around the middle of the book, is a separate piece, which no one's favorite book is a separate piece. I might be a bit biased having read that when I was 15 and despised it, but no one's favorite book is a separate piece.
And I will direct everyone back to the earlier Sophomore Lit episode about that. That was probably the most painful book I've had to read for this this podcast. But let's talk a little bit, just as a jumping off point, about his English teacher, Bill, and all these books were given. Because I've said before in this podcast, I'm always fascinated when authors mention books inside of books. It always seems like that's supposed to be highly meaningful, and it's supposed to reveal something about character. In this case, though, there are so many books that he's given to read, and they are kind of what you'd expect. You know, they're The Catcher in the Rye, they're The Stranger. What were some of the other ones he read?
The Fountainhead, which was really weird. Why would you give a 15-year-old the Fountainhead?
Right. Some of the ways that he talks about these books, when he talks about The Fountainhead, he's sort of like, he tries to make the point that, oh, it's a good book because you engage with ideas whether you agree with them or not. I don't think it's a good book, though, is the thing. I mean, I unfortunately have agreed to eventually do an Ayn Rand on this podcast.
Oh, and oh, you poor man.
I'm not looking forward to it.
Bill says it's specifically whenever he gets to that book, which I think is the last book that he assigns Charlie, like, with this one, I don't want you to be a sponge. I want you to be a filter.
Right.
Which Charlie has no idea what he's talking about.
Bill is a little too good for this world, I feel. He's that kind, that model of a teacher who comes along at exactly the right time in your life to give you what you need. He's never really given, I think, much to do as a person himself. He's there more as the just this endless source of knowledge for, and he's also there to he's there to validate Charlie's experience. He's the one who tells Charlie that he's a good writer and that he could someday become a brilliant writer.
Paul Rudd in the 2016-15 the adaptation that was actually directed by the author, actually. The Bill is played by Paul Rudd, mm-hmm. which I think was a great casting choice on their part, because you get the sense that through his performance, which you don't get too much in the book, that Bill understands there's something. This kid is going through something, and is perhaps a bit of a depressive, and is really trying to get this kid to engage with the world and trying to reach out to him. But the best way that he can figure out to do that is to assign him these books to read.
Yeah, definitely. We should definitely talk about the movie by the end of this episode, because I also watched the movie after reading the book just to get my head around what was going on. It is unusual to have a book that it has the screenplay and written by the author and directed by the author, because that really shows what the author thinks is important in the story. I think that there were some choices made in the movie that are fairly strong choices that clean up a few of the things that I thought were a little bit lacking in the book. And certainly when you get Paul Rudd in, first of all, you have to say, like, what the hell is this guy doing teaching high school? but secondly, yeah, he's going to make some strong choices that aren't necessarily in the dialogue itself and elevate that character, because Bill never really came off that strongly to me in the book.
That's a problem I have with reading it this time that I had with a lot of the characters, actually, even the ones we spend a lot of time with. Like Sam and Patrick, like we do get a lot of them, but I think the letter format, like the episcopatory nature of the novel, is limited in a lot of ways. It's good that you get a real, it's good at giving you a real sense of like how Charlie views the world, but because it's in this format, it's very limiting when it comes to all of the other characters.
It's a very novelistic thing to do, to write an epistolatory novel. And it's also very novelistic to make it into a character we don't know who it is. I mean, as I was reading it through, I was just kind of assuming that this was all just a construction on Charlie's part that he was doing to as some way of allowing himself to write his thoughts down. And it didn't really sound anything more than like writing into one's diary. You know, we have this story at the beginning, like, you don't know who I am. Sort of, it's all hand wavy. But then at the end of the novel, we're treated to this long thing about, oh, because you didn't sleep with that person, you could have. And like, so suddenly at the end of the book, it's like, he's going back and he's going to say, no, this really was a real person he was writing to all along. And I found that kind of weird. I felt strange about that. Like, I didn't understand ultimately what the point was, you know, in the same way that I never quite understood what the point was in Charlie's brother and sister never getting names. That's another thing that's a very novelistic thing to do, is to give a character who doesn't have a name. And usually that has a thematic reason. But I could not think of one single reason why Charlie wouldn't just call his brother and sister by their names.
Yeah, I mean, in, not to get too extra textual with it, but in the commentary track for the movie, the director slash author slash screenwriter is mentions towards the end actually why he chose to do that, which is that he wanted to he wanted to leave it open-ended as to who this person he was writing to was, because he wanted it to be like Charlie was writing these letters directly to the reader. But by him going at the end and mentioning these specific things that, you know, this person could have slept with this other person at this party, but he didn't, and that's why Charlie trusts him, makes it a bit too specific for it to, it makes it a bit too specific, and then it stops becoming universal at that point. So I don't know if it succeeds on that front either. You know, it is weird. Yeah, I don't really know why he chose to do it this way, to have it be these letters. You know, I don't really see why how it adds much to like the theme, to the novel thematically. You know, I mean, maybe you can say, by giving it this very narrow perspective, it shows how Charlie is very closed off from everyone else around him because of all the things that he's been through. But you could very easily do that with like a first person narration as well.
I think that authors often get very hung up over this whole issue of why is the main character talking at all. You know, I used to get in trouble when I was in fiction writing classes, because I would just write crazy things. Like, I was really in love with the idea of writing second-person stories. I had just read Carlos Fuentes' short novel, Ara, which is written in second person, and I thought that's a great device. It's just interesting to me, and I never thought too deeply about why that happened, but it would drive my professors crazy. They would say, like, but I feel like authors sometimes get really hung up over how this book came to be in your hands at that moment, and I feel like it's all fiction in a way. You know, it could just be people having an internal monologue.
It's a very like 18th century like way to think about a novel. Like, it was in those cases, it was always like letters that someone's writing, or like the character's autobiography that they had written at the end of their life or something.
Right.
Like Jane Eyre or something. Like, that's supposed to be like her a book that she is actually writing.
There are some interesting choices that Chbosky makes, which this style of writing allows you to do, which is, what Charlie decides to discuss and what he doesn't decide to discuss are very revealing about his personality. There's a sequence early on where Charlie's at a party and someone asks him what his favorite color is, and he goes into a long discussion about that, and then he says, and then they told me what theirs was. And we and it's a very clever sort of little thing in there where you can see as a reader a little bit of Charlie's weirdness. Although now that I say that, the thing that's funny about that is that we're told that Charlie's superpower is his ability to observe things about people. And I don't know that I buy that. I think that Charlie lives very much in his head. He's very concerned with his own thoughts and feelings, but those thoughts and feelings are always filtered through the lens of culture. They're always about this song was meaningful to me, this book was meaningful to me, not this happened to me and I felt this way about it.
Yeah, it's one thing I appreciate is that about the format is that I think it does capture very well like the way that like 14 like in 15 year olds write. It's very like a lot of very short sentences all stacked on top of each other, not too much description, and it feels like it's rushing through some things sometimes, which was certainly how I wrote when I was 15. But then whenever Bill like says at the end about how like great a writer he is, I'm like, I don't know, Bill, I've been reading like 200 or some pages that this kid has written, and I'm not too blown away by it. There are a few good moments though.
I do think that this is a fairly competently and sometimes beautifully written book. There are passages that are lovely, and I do think that the Chbosky works hard at the simulation of a teenager's voice. I would like to touch once more on this issue of the world of music and movies and culture that Sam and Patrick bring Charlie into. One thing I wanted to say really quickly here is that you do mention that there's a lot of Smiths talking here. The one thing that amuses me as a person who actually was a teenager and then a college student in the mid to late 80s is that there's a real selective memory people have about that time in music. I think today everyone looks back at the new wave bands of that era and says, oh, that was such great music back then. It was, you know, everyone seems very happy to talk about that stuff. And you know, I lived through it, and I'll tell you, that was not what people were listening to on the radio. People were listening to, you know, Michael Jackson. They were listening to Madonna. Not that there's anything wrong with those things, but that was what was basically people were listening to. They were listening to, you know, really silly pop music. There was a lot of it. And the Smiths was not a well-known band in this country until after its dissolution, I think, and there was a kind of a reexamination of new wave music that took place in the early 90s by you know, all the Gen Xers who were now in their 20s, who were like looking back on with some nostalgia on their teen years, and I think that people rediscovered all that stuff afterwards. So I just want to say the kids here are very precocious in their tastes.
I did like how Chbosky like characterized all of them by the things that they as a group have in common that they like in culture, and it's fun seeing how they differ. Like Sam and Patrick are both very into new wave. So then that gets trailing anyway, but like Mary Elizabeth is really into like Billie Holiday and like French films. and Alice is like into is like really into like goth and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's really one thing like in teen movies that I or like or YA books that I find annoying is like when everyone, all of like the kids in like one friend group are into exactly the same stuff, which is never the case. You'll have like a general like pool of stuff, like underground stuff that you all will be into, but then you'll have like your different subgenres that everyone kind of gravitates more than other people in your group.
Right.
I liked that he did that.
One thing that was funny about the movie for me is one of the scenes in this film, which is a sort of a central, I don't know, set piece in this film, is the Patrick and Sam taking Charlie out driving through a tunnel. This all takes place in Pittsburgh, and they're driving through this tunnel, and it's supposed to be this moment of exhilaration and freedom. And in the book, they were listening to like Fleetwood Mac or something.
I think they were listening to like Landslide.
And then in the movie, very pointedly, they're listening to David Bowie's Heroes, and it becomes this sort of a subplot in the movie of them trying to find out what this song is, because none of them know this song. Now, first of all, David Bowie's Heroes is one of his most popular songs. I don't know.
I thought that was funny too. That's up there with, you know, like in Juno. One thing I always had a problem with was that Ellen Page's character didn't know who Sonic Youth were. I'm like, listen, everything that you've told me about this character up to this point would lead me to assume that she would know who Sonic Youth are. Like,
and then the movie repeats this at the end. It's the credits music is Heroes, and that makes this song into like this central metaphor of the movie, which it was completely absent for the book. And I feel like this shows the mutability of memory. I mean, certainly Chbosky is not simply writing his experience, but he is trying to capture something of his experience. And there's something odd to me about the fact that between the time this book was written and the time the movie was made, suddenly, I don't know, maybe he went back and rediscovered Bowie's Berlin trilogy or something like that.
This was what me and the friend that gave this book to me, she was, because of the movie, she then became obsessed with David Bowie and got me into it because of that. So, though the Berlin era is not my favorite, I will say.
Are you more into Hunky Dory?
I have strong opinions about which is better, Hunky Dory or Spiders or Ziggy Stardust and Spiders from Mars, but we'll not get into that.
Okay. Rocky Horror Picture Show. Central, very central to this book. A lot of important sequences take place because Charlie and his friends are all members of the local cast for the Rocky Horror Picture Show live show. I find that a little bit hard to believe that a group of high schoolers would lay claim to that. You know, it's been years since I've been to a Rocky Horror Picture Show showing. I did that back in college. But that tended to be like that there would be like established you know, casts that would work out things with the local movie theater. I don't know. Do people still go to the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Whenever I was a teen, a youth, we would go, but we were in no way involved with the production. It was all like people in like their late 20s, early 30s that were putting this on. So I thought it was very strange too that all of these high schoolers were very central to the production of this thing.
I think that a lot of that is kind of authorial maneuvering to get Charlie and Sam into the position where Charlie is playing Rocky and Sam is Janet, and they're doing the "Touch a Touch a Touch Me" song.
That really made me uncomfortable. I'm gonna be honest, because like. because like she is a senior, like she's like 18 and he's like 14, 15 in this, like it's not a huge age gap, but when you're in high school it is. So that, I thought that was a little weird, but same with like whenever he was dating Mary Elizabeth. There were a few, like, in my high school, there were a few, like, seniors that were dating freshmen, but to get real, like, it was usually, like, older guys that were dating, like, younger freshmen.
There is a bit of this, the relationship between Charlie and Sam feeling like some sort of wish fulfillment on the author's part. I mean, I know what it was like to be a teenage boy, and to there is a feeling you have. Actually, scratch that. It doesn't matter what gender you are. It doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is. Whoever you are as a person, there's a time where you're the one who feels like you're naive and jejune, and someone comes along who's just a few years your senior who seems impossibly sophisticated. And this book does capture that feeling of what it's like to long for that, to long to just be a part of that and to be near that. But what it doesn't seem realistic to me is the idea that Sam would turn around and develop feelings for Charlie in that way.
Yeah, the author seems to be like trying to have his cake and eat it too in certain ways with Sam and Charlie's relationship. Like, he's trying to, how to best put it, like, she is at one point like very aware of like their dynamic, about Charlie's feelings for her, and she does her best to like dissuade him because he's younger, and sees it, I think, more as like just, you know, that kind of crush that you have whenever you're younger, right? But then at the end, she says to him like very point blankly that like the only reason that she didn't pursue anything with him was because that he was too passive with her, which didn't really feel like, it didn't really set with me that that's how their relationship was established early on, you know.
Yeah, there do seem to be some odd reversals that go on here. I'll pick this up a little bit later because I want to talk about this whole issue of Charlie's alleged wallflowerness and the way in which he's told by Bill to be more engaged with life. Because the author makes this late in the book discovery about abuse that that bothers me. But before we get to that, I want to touch on the other major relationship in here, which is Patrick and Brad, and Charlie's relationship with Patrick as well. When I was a teenager back in the 80s, there was not a lot of representation out there anywhere. You know, it was like maybe in adult novels you would find representation of queer people. You don't. I have to say I applaud this book for this, but I also can't really, in some ways the whole story about Patrick and Brad seemed a little bit, I don't know, a little, this seems like a cliche that I've come across quite frequently of the closeted quarterback, but maybe, you know, I feel bad about talking about that as a straight guy. What were your thoughts on Patrick and Brad?
Well, speaking for all queers,
speaking for you.
I understand. Yeah. I was like deeply closeted whenever I first read this, so I can't. I didn't really relate a lot to Patrick's storyline whenever I first read this. And something that a lot of straight authors, especially like straight authors of like YA fiction, don't seem to understand is that whenever you put stories like this, like, you know, the two closeted kids who like have to like, you know, have to keep it very secret, and especially if they're like side characters, queer teens don't see themselves that way. Or have a harder time relating to that, you know. It, and if you're closeted, it certainly does not empower you to, you know, embrace your sexuality or your identity or anything like that, you know. And there is a way to like portray the realities of like being a queer teen and like and all of the struggles that do come with that, while not frankly scaring teens who might be reading it, like a more recent like YA novel that I think does a very good job of this is like Dante and Aristotle Discover the Secrets of the Universe. It's not set present. I forget exactly when it's set, but it focuses on like two queer kids falling in love with each other, and their families aren't really supportive of their relationship, but it never ventures into like tragedy porn or anything like that. I feel like I'm being very incoherent with this, but it I don't know. It's tricky, yeah. Especially if you're sitting in a time where it's not as acceptable to be queer as it is now, you know.
Well, I think that this is one of the things that, one of the reasons why Rocky Horror Picture Show is such a central part of this book is Rocky Horror was a place for kids from the suburbs, you know, I hate to say it, white middle-class kids from the suburbs, to go and play at being transgressive for a while. You know, it was a kind of a safe space to investigate issues with sexual identity and certainly gender roles. I mean, today you look at the Rocky Horror Picture Show and some of the categories and terminology it uses are not what I think more contemporary gender theorists would use. But it was a kind of a great way to give people permission to do that, to play at that. And so that it does make sense that that would be a part of the book.
That certainly is still the case, or at least it was the case for me. Like whenever I was 15 and like watched Rocky Horror for the first time, that was like the first time I encountered any characters that didn't fit within the gender binary. And I really, at the time, really related is a strong word, but I felt very strongly about those characters in a way that I couldn't really identify until I was much older, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's like this, that's one, Patrick and the scenes where Patrick really, around the midpoint of the novel, whenever him and Brad are forced to break up, are whenever I most strongly wished that this wasn't so central to Charlie. Like if, like maybe it was like multiple different first person narratives, which sort of defeat the purpose of the novel. But I really, really wish I knew more about like what Patrick was feeling during that time, you know? And that would certainly, I think, go a long ways to making this a better portrayal of queer characters if you can actually get a sense of like what these two people are going through, you know?
Right.
Also, like the Charlie himself, one thing that I noticed this time that I had completely forgotten about the first time that I first time that I read it is hinted at not maybe being 100% straight, but the author sort of doesn't do anything with this.
Yeah.
Like whenever he I think it's whenever he kisses Mary Elizabeth for the first time, or maybe he's talking about how he's never been kissed. Later on, he talks about how whenever he was a kid, like a little kid, he would be playing with his friends and he would like kiss boys and stuff, and that's worried his father, and that is not mentioned ever again. Yeah. But then later on, he lets, and whenever Patrick is dealing with his breakup with Brett, Patrick starts making out with Charlie, and this continues on for seemingly like several weeks or maybe a month or so, and Charlie just lets him because he's, you know, in being a good friend, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, even if you are a very passive character like Charlie is, I don't know if a straight boy would let that sort of thing continue, you know?
Yeah, I kept waiting for the shoe to drop there. I kept thinking that this was going to be a story, but maybe that would have been a cliche too, a story in which Charlie fell for both Sam and Patrick. But we ultimately get told at the end of this book is, oh, it turns out that Charlie is an abuse survivor, and it's really only dealt with in literally the last five or six pages of the book.
Yeah, that I mentioned to you before we did this that I had forgotten just how dark this novel is in certain points, and I had completely forgotten everything with his aunt until like the first, like, I got like 10 pages in or so, and whenever he mentioned his aunt, it all came rushing back to me. And I was like, oh god, I recommended this book, I've got to talk about this now.
Right.
That's gonna be fun. And then I remembered like how late it came in, how late that reveal was, and it really colored my reading of this whole thing. And I don't really know how it sets with me, because it's almost played like a twist, you know, that's meant to like explain everything that's been going on.
That's the thing that bothers me about this is, Charlie is an interesting character. He's not, he is so socially awkward, but it's not a social awkwardness that comes from, say, being on the autism spectrum. He's actually very sensitive to other people's feelings at all times. That's a something of a burden to him, is how strongly he feels other people's feelings. He just is not interested in asserting himself in any way, and he's interested in pleasing people when he can. That's all he wants to do, and it makes him something of a frustration to his girlfriend. It makes him something of a cipher to the people around him. Now, those are all interesting characteristics, and it makes for a different point of view. But then if you make this all at the end like, oh well, it explains that he just can't stand physical touch because he's still in feeling PTSD from this, but he just didn't realize it, that bothers me, because that makes his whole personality into a problem, and it wasn't a problem up to that point.
Yeah. And also, I don't, if you're going to go for that, I mean, I don't want to speak for victims of abuse and, you know, say that, you know, everyone's experiences are the same, but he has been involved with like other people up to that point towards the end, whenever he's in Sam's room, right? So for these memories to resurface then doesn't feel quite right, you know?
Yeah, now, it's interesting that when the movie comes along, I think that Chbosky tries to integrate this storyline much more into the full movie. There's hints at it much earlier in the movie. The whole final segment after Charlie has something of a breakdown and has to go spend some time in a psych ward, that's much longer in the movie. And that's such an odd thing, because typically movies have to compress and they take out plot lines, but it seems more like Chabowski kind of doubled down with the movie and decided to make this much more of an integrated part of the story. I feel like that is a little bit more successful, but I still feel bothered by the fact that this whole storyline sort of invalidates Charlie's personality in some way, or makes it all like a riddle to be solved.
Yeah, it's like as soon this comes like at almost the very, very end, I think within the last 20 or so pages. So once that's revealed, it's basically the following letters are basically like, now I'm in the hospital, people are coming to visit me, I have figured out this thing that's happened to me, so now I can move on with my life, you know? Everything is solved, basically. which I feel like I wish this had come earlier if you're going to do this, you know, like maybe like towards the midpoint or so that you can actually see him working through all of this and actually examine like what the repercussions of like him rediscovering these suppressed memories would actually be, you know? Because as it stands, it's very much like, oh, like you said, we've solved the riddle. Now it's time for the novel to end. One other book that I read at around the same time was Ned Vizzini's It's Kind of a Funny Story, which was made into a very subpar movie starring Zach Galifianakis. Which is basically like, hey, what if One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but with teens? I cannot speak for the quality of this because I have not reread it since I was 15. But there is no like central trauma or anything surrounding that. It's about a teen dealing with depression and then him going to the hospital, going to the hospital and then, you know, staying there for about a week or so. A week or so or something like that. There is no repressed memory of like some sort of like past trauma that he went through. It's just, this is a kid with a depression and he has to learn to like navigate life like with this mental illness, which felt a lot more, as a 15-year-old with a depression, felt a lot more true to life to me at that time. Again, I do not know if it actually holds up. From what I remember, I don't think that novel's treatment of women is particularly good. But that aspect of it felt a lot better, more well handled than this.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about the movie here, because we have spoken about it for a while. You say you saw the movie first, or you read the book first?
I read the book first. I read the book like 2 years before the movie came out.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, so we were actually excited. We actually had a bit of an anticipation leading up to the release of it, because we were familiar with the book.
Now, the movie was 2012, and it's got an amazing cast. I mean, it's got a lot of really, aside from, as we've mentioned before, Paul Rudd. It has like all these people in like throwaway roles. You know, Joan Cusack plays the psychiatrist at the end of the film. She's just like, wait, that's Joan Cusack in there. And then you had like Dylan McDermott playing the dad, and you had, you know, of course the biggest person in this is probably Emma Watson as Sam, and she does a very credible job with her American accent, I have to say.
Oh yeah, yeah. She was really good in this. I really liked Ezra Miller as Patrick in the movie.
Uh-huh.
'Cause I think in the book they talk about how he's you know, he's kind of the jokester of the group, you know, is always making jokes and stuff. But that comes through, I think, a lot more in the movie, and was a lot more. Patrick was a lot closer to me as to like who I was as a high schooler, very much, you know, using humor to like deflect any serious emotion at all. or the fact that I was queer. The one thing I like about the movie is that it solves one problem that I had with the book, in that it's so very central on Charlie, and you don't get to spend too much time with the other characters. Now that it's outside and on the screen, and you have actually, you know, people there performing these roles, you can get a better sense of like what these characters are like, right. Which I really enjoyed.
There are more sequences in the movie of Charlie having sort of slight breaks from reality, and I think that that's underscored more, and so that does play more to the eventual reveal of trauma. Whereas in the book, again, it seemed to be much more just about being a teenager and being, I wouldn't say being in love, but being in love with the first people that are that important to you in that in your life. Mm. And I guess that's a very small story, but it's a story that I think is a lovely story, because I think it's one that we all tend to have. I don't want to say Chbosky can't do a film about mental breakdowns or whatever, but whenever people do things where there's this strong psychological component, I start to worry about the author making things up about the mental processes that go on here. I think that, you know, unfortunately, One of the bad things about the way that mental health is dealt with in our culture is it gets used quite often in storylines to just say, oh, this happened now, you know, and at the end of this book, Charlie blacks out and wakes up with all these memories back. And I feel like, is that really something that would happen to somebody finally breaking through a repressed memory? Or is this just like what the author feels? I mean, again, I feel like I don't want to be a jerk about this. Maybe Chbosky, you know, wrote a lot of this book from his own personal experience, and I don't know whether he's writing any of this part from personal experience, but this part felt less real to me than a kid obsessively writing down every song that he'd put on a mixtape.
Yeah, one thing, that movies, I think, is very hard to capture is, like, suppressed memories, because we can't get so directly into the head of a character like you can in prose. It's a lot harder to portray that. You were never like unaware of those things, just from my own personal experience. Like, it's always there. It's just like a sort of willful, in my personal case, I should specify, it's there in the back of your head, and you are aware of it, but you sort of like willfully rewrite it, so that it is more bearable, you know, and that's a lot harder to do in a visual medium, because it usually just comes across as, oh, like a sudden revelation, you know?
I feel like sometimes on this podcast, I come across as more critical than I mean to. It's easier to bring out the things that you pick apart in a book than it is to necessarily gush on the book. But I have to say, I did enjoy reading this book. It did remind me of what it was like to be young and obsessed, and it reminded me once again, of the strange process of making mixtapes.
That was so alien to me. Why don't you just make a Spotify playlist for it, Charlie? It'd be way easier. The only part of that I could relate to at all was that whenever he's making a mixtape and the tape breaks or like gets jammed, the only reason I can relate to that is that I was in a band whenever I was 16, and I was very into lo-fi recording. So I went on eBay and got a bunch of blank cassettes tape in a cassette 8-track recorder.
Oh my god!
Because I was terrible, and I forced my band to record all of these onto these terribly, terrible sounding cassettes. That I could not hand these out to anyone. Yeah. And it was a pain to convert them to digital. I don't know why I did this.
Right. Well, when I was in college, I was really into radio drama, and I was trying to record a radio drama with some friends of mine, which I never was able to actually mix down. It's probably good that I never did, because I also didn't understand anything at the time about royalties and copyright. And I probably would have gotten into a lot of trouble, but I recorded it, and I had the idea that I needed to record it on reel-to-reel because somehow I had it in my mind that that was better quality recording. That was what, like, everyone, you know, used to watch movies. So I got myself a reel-to-reel recorder that I got from, like, the media department of my college. And I recorded these reel-to-reels. And for like 20 years after that, I carried the masters of these tapes around, wondering if I could ever do anything with them, because I had no way of playing them.
Let me try and one-up you. Whenever I was 16, excuse me, my band, Fat Ricky and the Soul Explosion, copyright 2016-15. We did not play soul music, and none of us were named Ricky. I convinced us that our magnum opus would be a concept album that was an adaptation of Ursula K. Le Guin's The Lathe of Heaven. So we recorded this whole like garage rock / like new wave / dream pop album onto these 8-track recordings onto cassette, and then I bought an eight millimeter camera, and I recorded like these elaborate, like terrible, like lo-fi, like early John Waters style, like type films, and they were like music videos for the different songs, and I was only able to sync the audio to one of them, and it was like. We didn't have any sets or anything, so we just ended up like setting up couches in like this field, and like we had like desks set up and stuff, and like we went to the like local Goodwill and bought costumes and stuff, and all of our neighbors hated us.
May I ask if these films still exist anywhere?
I'm sure they do. I can call up my parents. I'm sure they have them in the outbuilding that we used as our recording studio. That thing did not have any sort of ventilation. So middle of summer, whenever we record all these, we were just covered in sweat in like 10 minutes. It's a wonder none of us died of heat stroke.
My request to you is that you get those things digitized and put them on YouTube for us all to see.
Oh, I will research how to convert 8-track recordings and somehow sync the audio to these 8mm film strips.
Okay, well, any final words on Wallflower before we leave it behind?
One section that I was amused by was the sections where he's in a relationship with Mary Elizabeth, and it's Charlie like sort of gets a taste of like what mansplaining is like. It's just where he just talks about how like she won't let me enjoy these things. She just gives them to me so she can talk at me about them, which I thought was very funny.
You know, I have to say, of all the characters in the book, I found myself rooting for Mary Elizabeth the most. I thought she was the most, in a weird way, the most relatable. She was like Sam and Patrick in that she was the keeper of culture for Charlie, but on the other hand, she was obviously riddled with her own insecurities and her own issues, and she was also played by Mae Whitman in the movie, and I just love her to pieces.
My favorite bit in the entire movie is whenever they are in Mary Elizabeth's house after the dance, the seduction scene, and she talks about how she after she goes to like Berkeley or something, she wants to become a lobbyist. Which I loved so much because most of my friends in high school were girls like this, and it felt very tailored to me.
Well, I'm glad that it's a book for a younger generation than mine, but I am glad that this book exists. I feel like this would be a much better book to give to kids than, say, the aforementioned A Separate Piece. Although I do wonder how much longer it can continue on before today's jaded teens look at it and say, well, what is the deal with these Smiths guys and this asleep song?
How did it, I am curious, how did it stack up against, you've read like three, I think, teen novels for this? Like, you got The Chocolate War, Forever, and The Outsiders. So you got like several different generations of teen novels, and this is kind of like you've almost done it in chronological order, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, I mean, you might throw into that as well The Giver, if you want to call that a young adult novel, and but that wasn't really about being a teenager. I would say the most interesting comparison to make for me would be to compare it to The Catcher in the Rye, because, first of all, this book makes so many explicit references to The Catcher in the Rye. The Catcher in the Rye is a better book. It's a better written book. This is a book that is, though, for kids. The Catcher in the Rye, I don't think, is written for kids. I think it's written for adults. And I think that this is a book that I'll say that this book takes being a kid seriously in the way that I also feel that Forever did. I think that Forever has a lot of really weirdly dated things today and a lot of things that don't make any sense, you know, about it. It was written at a time when there was extreme permissiveness in sexuality, and there was this expectation that kids would also participate in that. You know, it was a book in which, after all, the mother and the father were sort of like, well, if you're going to have sex, you have to have these condoms or whatever and all this stuff. And I feel like that it's sort of like an alternative universe in which the Reagan years never happened. but I do think the thing that I did like reading about it was that it took the experience of being a kid seriously. And I think this book takes the experience of being a kid seriously, too.
Also, both of the queer characters get to live at the end of this one, which was, I appreciated.
Yeah, well, Forever it was touch and go.
That is like, I read that like 4 years ago or so, I think. Whenever I read that, I just, at the reveal, like, if this was a movie, it would just be a dramatic smash cut to that scene, and then like an aside in Arrested Development almost.
Yeah,
and then back to the main action. It felt very weird.
It only took Forever was like 74. This was like 99. So it only took like 25 years for the queer side kid to not have to go through a suicide attempt. Maybe in another 25 years, you know, he'll be able to get the guy in the end.
Maybe. We can but hope. It truly, we live in the best of all possible worlds.
Thanks to my co-host, Hayden Gibson. Hayden has two podcasts, They See Me Rollin' and That Gay Shit. The reading this time was by Brian Hamilton. Brian can be heard on his podcast, Most Important Meal. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Email me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join the Facebook page or look for us on The Incomparable Slack. Keep up the reading, and remember, everything will be on the final.